Okay, good morning. First, let me thank the organizers for letting me present this work here. It's a very nice program, and I'm very happy to be here. So I'm going to talk about adaptive genome evolution by punctuated fitness waves. So here we are going to explore this asexual modes of evolution that got to be known by the name of traveling fitness waves, but in the context of explicit genome models. And as we'll see throughout, and I hope it becomes clear, so this imposes strong constraints to theories of fitness waves and generates new regimes, new evolutionary regimes. So we are going to discuss about these punctuated fitness waves. So this is based on a collaborative project between various members of the group of Professor Michael Lessig at the University of Cologne. So before starting, I want to thank everybody that's involved. So Thorsten Held and Daniel Klemmer, they are two PhD students at the group. Simone Pompei, he's a postdoc. And then, of course, Michael. Okay. So our system here, our system today is asexual populations that evolve by genetic drift, mutations, and selection. And because these are non-recombining populations, then sequence and fitness diversity will also be shaped by background and interference effects. We are interested here in what fitness wave theories have to tell about this story. So let's just make a brief reminder of this. So I guess we can say that fitness wave theories have been a success story in population genetics in the last decade. And in particular, because it let us, or it gives us a way of calculating or having analytic expressions for telling how quickly populations will adapt in terms of its parameters. So population size and mutation rates. And it has been usually addressed in the context of infinite size model. And here you need to specify then the size of the population and a distribution of input distribution of mutation effects, which then fixes the mutation rates and what is the effect that these mutations have on fitness. So then from there you can compute your everything you want. So just to illustrate a simple place where all these things already come together, so we can think of small populations in the limit of low mutation rates. And here the population is monomorphic almost all the time. So the mutations that arise, they fix, and if they manage to survive genetic drift, they just fix, and then the next one comes, and then it fix, and so on and so on. So the average fitness variance in this regime is just linear in the mutational input. So by average fitness variance, I'm going to use throughout the talk sigma square. So I might use it interchangeably, like sigma square or variance of fitness, but they just mean the same thing. So this doesn't have anything to do with waves, but then if we go to the scenario of these fitness waves, this would be the situation where we think about large populations which have high mutation rates. And so the idea here is that mutations arise faster than what they can fix most of the time of the in the population. And then because of that, there is some the dynamics of substitutions in this system has some effect of collective nature, which creates this regime of interference selection. So a signature of interference is that the fitness variance is sublinear in the mutational input. And in the regime of the asymptotic regime of these fitness waves, where you have the mutation effects that are infinitesimal, it has been computed in works of Neher, Halacek, and so on. So, I mean, there are many people that are in this room worked on this thing, so it's quite intimidating to talk about this here. So this has been computed. And the important thing that I want to stress is that the variance of fitness in this regime has this characteristic behavior, which the mutation rate depends on. So it depends on the mutation rate with this 2/3 power. So then later they showed that it has been discussed by Neher, Halacek, that these traveling fitness waves, they belong to the same these systems of, or that are described by traveling fitness waves. They belong to the same universality class that is associated of Bothausen's Nitman coalescent processes, and that are seen to describe populations, the genealogy of populations that are evolving under selection. Okay, just to look at it with a little bit more detail. The idea to keep in mind here when we are talking about these fitness waves is just that you have a population where with all these mutations around, and they have small effects, so many of these mutations get stuck at small frequencies. So this builds a variance in the distribution of fitness in this population. And this variance can be described by a function that has a Gaussian bulk and a stochastic tip, something as it is illustrated here. And as the system adapts, then this wave moves to higher values of fitness, and that's why it's a traveling fitness wave, if you will. So we can look at what happened in an interval of time, in the displacement of this wave in an interval of time. So if you do that, after an interval of time delta t, say, this wave will move to the right, or to have a displacement given by the speed times delta t. And from Fisher's theorem, we know that this speed should just be given by the variance of this distribution. So on average, this thing will move to the right sigma squared delta t. Now, if you look at a given point in time, it's not quite true because of this stochastic tip. So sometimes the width of this wave is slightly bigger than sigma, sometimes slightly smaller. So now, if we want to, we can write, we can, if we look at this specific point in time, we can then define the selective fitness flux, this quantity, which is just the integral over the instantaneous variance. And this quantity will then follow a random walk, because we have this stochastic tip with small increment, fluctuations on top of this average. And if this now follows a random walk, then we can write a probability. We can write a probability distribution for this advance in fitness by this wave, and it should be given by a Gaussian distribution with average then sigma squared delta t, which is this mean variance. Okay, so in this talk we are interested in this traveling fitness waves, but here we want to consider explicit genomic models. And as we are going to see, the framework of these genomic models let us have a clear distinction of evolutionary equilibrium and non-equilibrium adaptive evolution. As I try to anticipate in the title, genomic viability imposes strong constraints on fitness waves, as we're going to discuss. And then we are also going to discuss a new universality class of adaptive genome evolution. So we will see basically that these genomic models, adaptation in these genomic models belong to a universality class that is different from the universality class of these Bothausen-Snitman processes or these diffusive behavior. Okay. So the way this story goes is that first you talk about equilibrium, then you talk about the non-equilibrium part, steady state adaptive evolution, and here we will encounter this new regime of punctuated fitness waves. And then I will try to discuss what all these findings might mean in light of laboratory experiments. But so this is a theory talk. So in principle, there is no experiment that was made or anything. So just it's a theory. It's a purely theory talk at the moment. Okay. Let's start with the equilibrium part then. Okay, so here I will present to you what is this genomic model that I so much talk about. So we want something very simple that can describe a genome. So basically what we are going to do here is that we are going to say our genome has some specific site, L, which is given by the number of sites that constituting this genome. And each site will have an effect on fitness that come from a distribution. You can just draw the effect on fitness that each site will have from a distribution. And as you illustrate here, each of these sites come in the form of two alleles. So we have a beneficial allele that's marked in blue and a deleterious allele that's marked in red. So then the effect on fitness here, that is the selection coefficient of each site, basically is given by the gap between beneficial and deleterious allele. So mutations will arise in this system at a rate mu per site. So it's indicated here by basically this the direction of these arrows, what is the mutation. So a beneficial mutation that goes in this direction is under positive selection, and it will eventually lead to a beneficial substitution that is illustrated by this blue arrow pointing to positive values of fitness. But then we also have deleterious mutations that go in that direction, and they are under negative selection, and eventually they will lead to deleterious substitution. So that is represented by arrows that have that point to the direction of negative values of fitness. So, and then, okay, this will be considered in a population of n individuals, and each individual will have its own genome. But one thing that I want to point out that I think it's quite nice in this story here is that when the mutations arrive here in this loci, they depend on the current state of the locus. So we cannot specify a distribution of mutation effects a priori as it's done in the infinite sites model. So here, the input distribution of mutation effects is something that depends on the state of the system. And okay, this is basically some important difference between the two models that I just wanted to point out. All right, so we implement this model. And then when we look at the variance of fitness...
Oh, sorry, I don't quite understand. How do they depend on the study?
Because when a mutation hits this, say, this guy here, it can only go to the deleterious. So if a mutation hits, or say, let's take this site I, position I. So if the mutation hits the site I, if it is on the beneficial allele, it goes to the deleterious. If it's on the deleterious, it goes to the beneficial. So it just go back and forth. So it's mutations and substitution.
And those distances are just something that those are just parameters in the model? Or?
Yeah, so these distances are basically the selection coefficients, which are drawn from some distribution. So. So here we fix the selection effect of the site, but this doesn't mean that we are fixing the distribution of input mutations, because the value that it will, how much this mutation contributes to fitness, it will depend on what was going on here already. So that is the idea. Okay, so now we implement this model. And then when we look to the variance when you look at the variance of fitness, so we look at the variance of fitness as a function of mu times L, because here we are interested in the mutation input, right? We find the same regimes that were expected from the theory. So first, for values of mu times L that are small, we find this linear regime. So the variance is behaving linear, so this is the same thing that happens in the regime of independent substitutions. So, and then at some point, as we increase mu times L, so this curve, this line starts to bend, and it starts increasing only sublinearly with mu times L. So basically, so the points here are results of simulation. And these dashed lines here are the expected, what we would expect from the theory. So you see that they agree very well. And this point of this crossover here is the value where mu times L is of the order of the mean value, mean selective effect of this distribution. So it's basically telling you that things are interfering. So it's consistent with that. It has a constant, not a constant, but a factor that depends weakly on the population size. But okay, so this this variance will change the behavior. There is this crossover that goes from the regime of independent substitutions to this regime of interference selection. And I just want to mention very briefly, I don't want to go into details now, but we can always discuss later if someone is interested. So in the setup of this genomic model, it is possible to write a self-consistency argument and to solve all this crossover analytically. So basically, this is what the line is drawn. And because of time, I'm not going to talk about it now. I guess I should have acknowledged all these people that that have worked on this. So these results here come from various references of Halachek and Neher and so on. So I apologize for not having acknowledged it before. But anyway, so the important information here is that in this genomic model, we can capture the two regimes that were already known from this theory of waves. So the regime of independent substitutions, and then this characteristic two-thirds power behavior that is on these both Hazen-Snipman waves. So now we can go back to the genome, and we can look at this, what's going on there. As it has been discussed again in various works in the literature, in Schiffels, in works of Good and Rice, and so we can look at the probability of an allele being fixed on of a site being fixed on the deleterious or in the beneficial allele that here we are going to call site occupancy, and it's given by this expression. And just like in the Kimura theory, it will depend on it can be put in a it will depend on a single parameter here, apart from the selection, but it will depend on a single parameter that tells you the difference between what is selective and what is essentially neutral in this system. And it has been referred to this, so I am going to call this sigma tilde throughout, and sometimes I will call emergent neutrality scale, as has been referred to in Schiffels. I think also in Rice it has been referred to as emergent neutrality scale. It has been also referred to as inverse effective population size, because this essentially works as an inverse population size. But I don't mean that this is an effective population size in the sense of that. I just mean that that here the fluctuations, that the size of the fluctuations that are allowed to happen, they depend only, so they will depend both on drift and some other effects, and they can be encoded in this variable, and that's it. But I don't refer to population sizes. But it has also been shown that this sigma tilde, when you think of it on a phylogeny, it's like the inverse coalescent time. Okay, so this expression is really nice, because when we compute the ratio between the probability of being fixed on the beneficial and in the deleterious allele, we basically get a Boltzmann factor that depends on the selection coefficient and on this neutrality scale. So here, I show this allele occupancy. So as the occupation of the beneficial allele goes from zero from half to one, we can see that the beneficial of the occupation of the deleterious allele goes from half to zero. So these points are simulations, results of simulations for various mu times L, and here we are plotting it with a scaled x-axis. So we have this nice collapse. So if you look at the fixation probabilities, expression for fixation probability on the beneficial and the deleterious allele, so this is again consistent with this the site occupancy, because these expressions can also be written in terms of this neutrality scale, and they have this very nice exponential form. That again, if we compute the ratio between beneficial and fixation in beneficial and deleterious alleles, they will give a nice Boltzmann factor. So then, if we use this information to compute the substitution rates, what we learn is that these substitution rates they satisfy the detail bounds. So they are given by this expression. And as we can see, I will come to the intuitive picture in a moment, but so they are given by this expression. So in the situations where S smaller than this sigma tilde, this fixation, the substitution rate is just given by mu, so neutrals, basically the neutral substitution rate. And for values of selection that are bigger than this sigma tilde, it fixes at a rate it subs, so substitutions happen at a rate much smaller than the neutral one. And maybe the intuitive way of seeing this is the following. So when the occupation of the beneficial allele is high, the only thing you can do is to go to substitute in the deleterious. So the probability of substituting this deleterious allele is very low. So you basically don't go there after some value of S over sigma tilde. So basically, you don't go to the deleterious state. You don't substitute there. And you would be able to substitute in the beneficial allele because the probability for these large values of selection coefficients, the probability of fixation in this beneficial allele is very high. But you are almost never in this deleterious states to be able to substitute there. So what it means for us is that there is a particular value of this selection or this scale selection coefficient, which let's say it's of order one, for which the dynamics of substitution is frozen. So whatever selection coefficient that whatever site that has selection coefficients bigger than one, they don't have basically anything going on there in terms of substitution dynamics. And everything that happens in terms of the substitution dynamics happens for values of selection coefficient that's smaller than the scale selection being one. That, as we can learn, basically substitute at a neutral rate. Why I'm telling all this story is because, okay, we have this very nice neutrality scale now, and we can see what happens. We can ask the question, how big is this thing? And we can see what happens, for example, when we change mu times L. So, and when it... A question? Or? Okay. So we can see what happens when we change mu times L. And then here, if we use this result of the fitness wave that tells that the coalescent time is set by selection, basically because the speed of the wave will tell, or the speed of the wave that is related to the variance, it will give you it will set the coalescent time. We can find two different regimes, and indeed, so let me just discuss it in light of this plot. So in green here, I'm showing the same thing that I had shown you before, which is the variance of fitness in these two different regimes. So we had the linear regime, and then we had this regime where variance was increasing with the powers of 2/3 of this characteristic Boltzmann-Snitman thing. So now if we use this relation, we can find these two regimes, but if you just look at the results of simulations, we also find these two regimes. We will have this regime where first nothing happens, and basically the so this is, what I'm showing here is this sigma tilde. So first, nothing happens. So basically, you have the same thing as in the Kimura single locus theory. So as you start increasing this mu times L, so this effective neutrality scale is start increasing. And then it just changes behavior after some point. But the point where it changes behavior, when you see, it's the same point where it crosses over to this regime of Bolthausen-Znidman waves. And what is remarkable here is that it happens at the value of so at the value where this thing crosses mu times L, it's the same point where it crosses S bar. So so what this means is that now, so S bar is just the mean selection coefficient of the genome. So what happens is that now our sigma tilde in this regime is bigger than the mean selection coefficient of the genome, which means that if you look at a typical site on this genome, S divided by sigma tilde, our scaled selection, is going to be now bigger or smaller than one. So when you cross here, this thing is bigger than S bar, so S divided by sigma tilde is going to be smaller than one. So so this means that if you look at the typical site in your genome, it is basically behaving neutrally. And how is this possible that we have most of the sites or a typical site behaving neutrally in the genome? So what we learned from this story here is that in this minimal genomic model, this regime where we have these Bolthausen-Znidman waves or these characteristic two-thirds power behavior in the variance, it's not consistent with genomic viability. But on the other hand, we also find this new regime here in which the variance of fitness still behaves as behaves increases linearly with this mutation input. So it is behaving essentially as in the regime of independent substitutions, but this neutrality scale is already set by selection because it's increasing. So for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to call this regime a regime of standing fitness wave. And this is the region of parameters where we could have some viable genome.
A short question on the dynamics. I think I get the overall picture of the different regimes, but what I'm fully missing is the concept of the fitness wave there, since we have like a finite genome. Do we have, is it like very, very large? And you just...
Yeah, so,
so it's like finite but super large.
Yeah, so...
And then we go in one direction, we can get the meltdown.
Yeah, so basically that's what happens here. So we check what happens as a function of increasing L. So you increase basically this variance and you build this wave. So in the regime of small L, basically you have single locus theory. And you can see again that this neutrality scale is just set by the Kimura thing. So basically your sigma tilde there is just like in the single locus. And then when you increase this thing, you start building some variance from all the contribution of the sites, and then you build this standing wave.
So, okay, yeah. Could you elaborate on standing and BS fitness wave again a little bit? On how, like, you know,
So here.
So does standing mean it just doesn't change precision?
Yeah, it just means that your values of fitness when they vary, if you look at it on a long scale, they are not really moving to the right because it's an equilibrium situation. So you have substitutions going on, but they are just like you have the same amount of beneficial and deleterious substitutions. So on the long term, you don't move this wave. So you're just having an equilibrium fitness wave, if you will. While in the BS, you are basically injecting mutations, and these mutations are creating these fitter individuals that are feeding the next generation and so on, and this thing is moving to the right. So I guess in the BS it's difficult to make a distinction between equilibrium and non-equilibrium, unless you go to some moving co-moving frame or so on. Fine, but then the thing is that in this genome, okay, so we argue that in this region of our parameter space, the genome is not compatible with this type of fitness waves. But then we can ask the question, what if we have adaptation, right? Because as you said, this is an equilibrium thing. How can we think of these fitness waves in the context of BS? So let's explore what happens when we add some adaptive pressure. So here the first thing we have to do then to consider this non-equilibrium situation is to modify this minimum model to include this adaptive pressure. And as it has been shown in Muston and Lessig in 2010, a very simple way of doing that is just by flipping the direction of selection at individual sites. And we'll say this will happen with a rate gamma, that from biological point of view, we can think it's some sort of rate of neofunctionalization event or so on, just to motivate a bit this thing. So when this flip events happen, the deleterious, so this is the idea of the model, how we implement this adaptive pressure. The deleterious allele becomes beneficial, and the beneficial allele becomes deleterious. And this creates this adaptive pressure that will eventually lead to adaptive substitutions.
Sorry, what's the motivation for that? Is that to incorporate epistasis somehow?
No. This is just to, we can think of having these sites having new functions. By epistasis, you mean you would have like these sites contributing non-linearly to the fitness, right? So this is no epistasis here. So here is just that they contribute additively. So
I really appreciate this as a theory talk, but I just want to understand how you imagine a selection flip to happen in the genome. So I wonder whether this is some thing emerging from things you've ignored so far, or how I have to understand this.
So I think one way you can think of it is like you have this this population there, and then it is adapting to a new environment. Sometimes it develops these new functions, and so this would be just a rate at which this thing develops new functions. So like neofunctionalization events. So you develop eventually you develop a new way of doing something in a different environment.
Okay. Yeah, but neofunctionalization assumes you have a duplication first.
Yeah, but this is a very simplified model, right? I mean, in principle, you can you don't have to do it at the level of single flips. You can always say, let's imagine
well,
we have
a good explanation is if you say you put your organism into a new environment and an allele that has been beneficial in the old one is now deleterious.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so that's
okay.
A very simple.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes me happy. Okay.
Yeah,
thank
okay.
You.
Thanks. Yes, but one thing that I have to tell here is that our x-axis now is not fitness anymore, as it was in the equilibrium, but it's fitness flux, and the fitness flux is a quantity that is used to quantify amount of adaptation in the sense that it gives you the change in fitness due to something, due to this adaptive process. So it can basically be formalized, written down formally, as the change of fitness due to contributions of mutation, the change of fitness due to contribution of selection. But for the purposes here, we can just think of it as the advance that we have. So the amount of adaptation is given by the advance that we have in this fitness flux. And if you just look at this, x-axis, then we would be able to, and we compare where the site was before and where the occupation of the site is now, we can compare how much this thing has moved to the right. So this gives us an idea of how much adaptation this this site or organism has acquired in the process. So we want to investigate what happens in this setup, right? We were saying in the in equilibrium, our genomic model is not so when we have this BS wave, it's not viable, compatible with a viable genome. So we will start here from this regime of parameters that we discussed before. It was this regime of standing fitness wave, so a viable genome, and we are going to add moderate adaptive pressure. And then we look at the behavior of this scale, the fitness flux, that is here is scaled in units of the mean selection coefficient, and we look at it as a function of time, and which here is a scale such that we can count the number of times that these flip events happened. And when we look at this fitness flux, we see a clear separation of time and selective scales. And this is quite cool, because what this is showing us is that we have these regions of quasi-equilibrium, where here, basically, we have these dynamics of substitutions, and the substitutions are happening in these sites of small effect at this rate mu. So on average, our fitness shouldn't increase or decrease. But then, this is true until a flip event happens. Because then when this flip event happens, you have these very large fluctuations of fitness flux. So you have these jumps, and these jumps that are caused by this. So we have these jumps. And the reason why these jumps happen is that, so when we look at the genome, and we have these opportunities for the flips, these flips can reach any site. So the sites that were with large selection coefficient that were locked before, where the dynamics of substitution was locked before in equilibrium, they are now put to game again. And they are, on average, like of much larger selection. Well, the selective effect is bigger than the average selection coefficient, or even bigger, even more big than that.
Sorry, I don't understand. Are you basically doing one set of flipping where you decide which positions to flip and then you basically get new mutations, or are you constantly flipping?
No, you flip at a rate. So you
continue flipping while time continues. But now I have a bit of a problem to translate this into a biological scenario. So you're thinking that the environment is changing constantly, that sites that were beneficial before become now deleterious? So this is the only way I can imagine that your environment is changing, and so then sites.
Yeah.
It's like if your fitness is from a lot of different traits, and like maybe only some traits are changing at a time, and so.
You can also see that.
Yeah, the thing is, what changes is that what is beneficial. That's the thing. So the environment is changing, and I find this a bit. To model the change in environment by randomly picking positions in the genome, I find a bit.
But this is not you say that more realistic way of implementing this thing is to say when you change the environment, only specific sites should be able to.
I'm happy to say that this is random, but I have an event that an organism moves from one thing to the other. The other thing is I have a problem. It's kind of. Your jumps come basically, if I understood it correctly, that you move, suddenly you flip one side with a big effect, and then you can have a mutation, and this allows this to sweep, yeah? But I'm lacking the link to biology for this, because...
So could it be that maybe epistasis causes something like that?
Oh, of course it can be many events, I just find it a bizarre way to what does it mean in terms of the shift of the environment? This would mean that there we suddenly have a big shift in the environment, because now suddenly you open the space for a new mutation.
But what I meant was, even without the environment, if you just have it, so you have the genome evolve, like changing at other sites, and that suddenly makes a particular focal site change direction. So, you know, if you have. I was actually wondering about that in general, whether. So you assume that there's no epistasis in this model. I'm assuming, I'm not actually 100% sure, but I think, you know, all the effects are independent of all the other loci.
Yeah. But you can, but this is one way of implementing it. So we have implemented this model in a different setup where we say there are whenever so this whenever this flip event happens, it affects various sites. So then there is a group of sites that is basically, so this maybe it would be more realistic in the sense of what you're saying. Like there's a group of sites that now contribute to this new function. And when you look at that model, you basically have the same behavior as you have here. It's just that this was a simpler way of connecting it with the equilibrium picture. But actually, when you look at that model, this behavior is even more pronounced there, because you somehow you suppress a little bit the size of the fluctuations that are happening in this, so you decrease. Can I continue, or? So let me see where I stopped. I was very happily right saying that that we have these nice regions that are separated and different things happen here. So here you have fluctuations on this dynamics of substitution that are of a small, that they are bound by this sigma tilde, and this is what we had in the equilibrium regime for the same parameters. And then you have these jumps. So these adaptive jumps in fitness. So basically here what you see is that the possibility of these adaptive, because of we have possibility for adaptive substitutions, we have this punctuated character of the behavior of our wave.
This somehow depends on the flipping wave or something.
Yeah, we are going to get there. It does. But this is really, really cool because now we see that fitness flux increases because of these adaptive sweeps, right? Why is really, really cool? It's because now we can ask what is the probability of increasing in what is the probability of advancing fitness flux here. So it should just be given by the number of jumps that you have in a period of time. And then if you want to know the value of fitness that it increases, then you have to multiply by your distribution of selection coefficients of the sites. So basically you obtain something like something that is given here with a linear dependence on the t, right? Because it depends on the number of the jumps. And then we can look, we can verify that this is the case if we investigate this this probability of fitness advance in some time scale that is the time scale bigger than the jump can sweep, can go through, and smaller than when you have many, many jumps. So this is the relevant time scale where we peak this increase because of the jump. So if we plot this probability density now scaled with this number of jumps for various parameters of various values of gamma and various and different times in this interval, what you see is that they all collapse. So we have this very nice collapse plot, which indeed recovers this distribution of selection coefficients of the site. And this is cool because, okay, maybe we could already have understood it from the other picture, but in this setup of in this adaptive genomic picture, adaptation is basically driven by these events of large effect and not by small effect diffusive things. So we can look at the moments of this distribution, and it shows these anomalous properties. So basically all the moments are going to scale linear with delta t. And again, this is quite cool because this type of scaling appears in some problems of Berger's turbulence. So Berger's turbulence is just some toy model that is used to describe turbulence. It's based on this Berger's equation that describes the dynamics of a velocity field that doesn't have curls. So basically, there is a limit of this Burgers equation for which you have something very similar there. So you have that this velocity field acquires some singularities. Maybe just to give the idea, the point is not to talk about that. So you have something like that, this velocity field acquires some singularities that are these Burgers shocks. And then if you can, okay, so they will have a characteristic amplitude, a characteristic width, and they will come at a characteristic distance here. So basically, if you look at the probability of the longitudinal, the difference between longitudinal velocities in some characteristic length, you get the same type of scaling for that quantity. So that's just an analogy. But yeah, the point here is that the evolution on this genomic framework is basically in this punctuated fitness waves is basically driven by this large effect substitutions rather than small.
Sorry, I think I'm just a little confused. So in this first point, you're saying that because these things are sort of flipping independently, you just typically fix like an average mutation that gets flipped from beneficial to deleterious, right?
Why average mutate? So say
like
again.
You have your distribution of fitness effects of the size of the mutations, and you're flipping the signs kind of randomly. And so in this time scale that you're talking about, you just wait around until you flip a typical effect guy to deleterious so that you can adapt by fixing the beneficial allele.
Mm-hmm.
So that if I think about adaptation over a long time, it should just be like the number of flips times these draws from this distribution.
Yeah.
So then I'm kind of confused about the second point, which is why wouldn't you expect this to be diffusive on long timescales?
So on long timescales, you would pick contributions of various.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
True.
But you're not waiting
out. We are looking at this. So we are basically looking at a time interval, which is just either you have a flip or you don't have a flip.
Okay, great. Thanks.
So I think this is just a continuation of
that. Yeah, but you easy there. Easy there. I'm scared of you.
I'm just trying to understand the sort of mechanism of the shock formation, right?
Yeah.
So, right, back in the traveling wave model, right, we sort of know that at least naively there is an instability where if the nose goes a little bit ahead of where it's supposed to be in this nice steady traveling wave, it will tend to accelerate, right? It will grow faster, so it will seed the next bin faster, so it will tend to accelerate, right? So there is this instability of the nose, and then there is a whole argument about how it will eventually saturate when the effect of the advanced nose will propagate into the bulk of the population, will shift the mean fitness, and right, so the bulk will sort of catch up with the nose, so there is sort of delayed stabilization. But there, of course, there's this notion that there are infinitely many beneficial mutations to be had. So if I understand correctly, you're rationing the number of possible beneficial mutations.
What do you mean by rationing?
Well, unless we've got your gamma parameter.
Ah, yeah.
Right? So we cannot generate the required beneficial mutations faster than they become available.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, and maybe that's. We had this little discussion here, right? And maybe I didn't understand. So there is ultimately, gamma sets the maximal speed, right? That's the speed of light. Traveling wave cannot move faster than gamma. Do you understand correctly?
Yeah. So you say traveling wave cannot move faster than gamma. So this gamma, so the traveling wave would...
gamma times L, I guess.
Yeah, gamma times L, yeah. So, but the thing is that there is this variance here. I have to think. Ask me again after the talk,
okay.
Because it's nerve-wracking to be in front of this camera. I'm serious.
Well,
yeah. I mean, it's just crazy.
We can stop the camera. Don't worry about the camera.
Can I make a suggestion to ask whether I understood it correctly? So if you get these switches, right, and Boris just said there's like an upper limit,
yeah,
and Christian suggested that it's funny to have them like one after the other. So would one picture be that you have a gradually changing environment, like temperature, and when you go up in temperature, like more and more of them can actually switch, but the speed, like the gamma is basically set by the change in temperature. Like if you change very gradually, you can't get more of these. Is that a picture which would make us happy, or you happy?
Yeah, I guess you can say that changing gamma is what is related to how you change your environment and how fast, because this is how you are. This is how basically gamma is the rate at which you are telling, okay, my beneficial sites are not good anymore, right? So basically, you are. I think so.
Are you going to explore gamma L larger than 1?
Do you want me to?
Yes.
Okay. I will, because the point here is, so I'm not doing very good in time, but okay. The point here is that I told you genome evolution goes in this different regime of punctuated fitness, right? But we can think, how are we going to lose this punctuatedness? I mean, if we increase the gamma, then again, so these very big jumps, they get smoothened out because you start having a bigger influx of these possibilities of adaptive sweeps and so on. And this is what we investigate now. So here, what I am showing is this, again, the same scaled fitness flux. And then we increase this adaptive pressure. And as you see, so as you increase, so here just the time is scaled so that you get, again, the same, you count the number of flip events. So here, you see that as you increase gamma, you lose this punctuated character of this wave. So you can... So you, what you see is that the statistics of the fitness flux become more diffusive as you increase this gamma. So you would expect something that's closer again to what you have in this VS regime. But then if you go and we look at our genome, what is going on at the genome again, so you basically look at the average occupancy of lambda plus, which is so whether all on average these alleles are all fixed on the positive or on the beneficial or in the deleterious. So here is in the beneficial. So we look at fixations there. So as we see, as a function of this adaptive pressure, there is always a value where of gamma times L where this will cross the value of S bar. So now we can think, okay, we need to find a way of thinking about this neutrality scale here. So it has been discussed in Schiffels that when you have a non-equilibrium situation like this, so the neutrality scale is basically set by the equilibrium neutrality scale, but then it has also a dependence on the number of flips, because when the flip event comes, if it's strong enough, then you have the substitution, so it decreases the the coalescent time. So this inverse coalescent time should increase. So the point here is that this can be written as the equilibrium sigma tilde plus some fraction, some constant that's smaller than one, that depends on the times this number of this rate of flips, because in here is just because not every flip is going to cause this substitution, but so it's just something. Some flips are going to affect this size of small effect, so they don't go through. But the important thing here is that this neutrality scale in the non-equilibrium setting, it always crosses to values bigger than S bar. And then from the same criteria that we had in the equilibrium before, we see that as a function of this adaptive pressure, this genome, the occupation of this beneficial allele, it always goes down. So basically this genome melts again. So the site starts getting randomized. So so I can just summarize all this discussion by looking at this. Let's summarize the discussion looking at this thing. So from the equilibrium, what we learned, it was that by increasing the number of loci, we could melt the genome. So as we increase the number of sites, and we melt the genome, but also as we increase the adaptive pressure, we learn from the non-equilibrium that we also melt the genome. So what we find here is that we had regions of molten genome basically separated by regions of viable genome. So in the limit where we had small adaptive pressure, we just recover our equilibrium situation. So for a small genome length, we had the regime of independent substitutions. Then we found this new regime of this standing fitness wave where the variance was still behaving like in the independent substitutions case, but our sigma tilde, this neutrality scale, was already set by selection. And then when I increased the genome length even further, we crossed over to this Bolthausen-Schmidtmann 2/3 power. So and the consequence was that there for the genome was that it was basically many of the sites were randomized, right? So we had this Milton. So if we go back to this, when we started again, the discussion of the non-equilibrium starting from this regime where we had a viable genome, and we increased the adaptive pressure. So what we saw is that this genome evolution was going through these punctuated fitness waves. So we found this different universality class. So for this process. And a viable genome, right? And then when we increased the adaptive pressure even further, then again, this thing was, as we saw from the genome state, we had again a genomic meltdown. So now I want to briefly just ask a question, because so we have seen in this program and many of the talks that when you go to the laboratory, so you do have fast adaptation and you do have strong clonal interference and all these things going on. And then this, if you look at a typical experimental day. So this is data from Michael's Desai group. So when you look at the frequency of lineages increasing as a function of time, you see here that there is something that rises, and then it fixes about 400 generations later. So it means that the coalescent time must be of order of a few hundred generations. So we do have short coalescent times. So the question is, what does this all mean, right? What I just told you here. So what I try to, I guess one point that I was trying to make is that you can have fast adaptation as when you increase the your gamma rate, but and maybe now I understand your question better. But so you can have fast adaptation when you increase this gamma rate, but it comes with the cost of all these things that you are carrying around. It comes with the cost of genetic draft. So in practical terms, maybe one way to just estimate, to have an idea of what does it mean, so we can write the rate of deleterious substitutions. This should just be given by the fraction of sites of this genome that is essentially neutral. So so we are going to call this by C, this fraction. So C times L is the number of sites for which the selection coefficient is smaller than the sigma tilde. So they, as we've seen from the discussion, the fixation rate there was basically the neutral fixation rate. And to estimate the decline in fitness, then we just have to know, so to see how much fitness we would lose because of these deleterious substitutions, we just have to consider the mean effect. At most, it's going to be the mean effect, right? But plugging in numbers for E. coli genome, what we would find is that the rate of deleterious substitution would cost us about one locus per year and a decrease in fitness of mean selection coefficient per year. So this is something that even in the longest term experiment that you would have of, I don't know, in the lab, you wouldn't be able to see, because how long you have to wait to see these effects, right? But on the other hand, if you think about long-term evolution in the wild, there you would be able to, like, their nature or evolution would have time enough to degrade this genome. So the question here is, like, whether when we think of evolution on the long term and evolution on the lab, is there something different? Is there something going on in the lab that is different from long-term evolution in the wild? So this is a question that we can think in light of this, all these things. So just to conclude.
Can I answer your question?
Yeah.
Sex.
Ah, yeah. I mean, of course, like
that's
here.
That happens. That's different in the.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, it's a very good point because.
Yes, microbes have sex.
Yeah. So this is one very interesting thing, because I think it was in this talk of Eric van Nimbegen that's here, right? He was saying that you don't know what these bacteria do in the wild. If you go there and look, there seem to have been a lot of recombination, even these bacteria that you don't think that they do horizontal gene transfer in principle, because I think they were E. coli or something. I don't remember, I should look, but yes, I mean you can ask the question, do you really have purely asexual organisms in the wild? I don't know, but it at least motivates us to think that observations on the wild are important, right?
Or if you have viruses and things like that, your length parameter gets small enough that it doesn't create the drag that you're talking about, potentially. I don't know if there's a length threshold in which sex becomes absolutely necessary.
Yeah, that's true.
Or is it? Or will you always get your predicted degradation under any length? Or if the adaptation is frequent enough, then
it's not under well, it, yeah, because here the variables are scaled, right? So here we are using scaled variables. So I think you can just plug in this length and mutation rate, and then you get what is your value of mu times L.
Maybe people have already written about this, whether or not these kinds of models make predictions about systems that can actually remain asexual versus not. Depend on the frequency of environmental shifts, is it maybe more common for microbes, maybe not.
I don't know if they have written, but I think the question is very interesting. Do any of you know about it, or?
You can work this stuff out with recombination, and it depends on how much adaptation you have. It sort of sets the scale over which things are typically asexual. So that can either be really short, like one site, in which case then the draft doesn't matter so much, or it could be really long, and then it can matter a lot. So.
Right. It's got to be scaled by length over the amount of environmental change or amount of adaptive change that's expected per unit sequence or something.
Yeah, well, and the strength of the fitness effect that gets uncovered by the change, right? So if the fitness effect S for a beneficial sweep, then you expect something like S over R bases to be sort of dragged up with it when it sweeps. And so if there's a lot of deleterious mutations in that size, then you, yeah.
Also the assumption that the genomic space is finite and just proportional to L as opposed to 4 to the L, you know, I think is rather questionable, right? So any sort of short period of time, we may be exploring just sort of finite number of roughly things, but I think on the scale of I, you know, millions of years that we're worrying about now, that's certainly not a reasonable assumption, right? As the sequence drifts or selects itself away into some other corner of the gigantic hypercube, more beneficial opportunities will present itself. So somehow worrying too much that this thing is going to run out of beneficial mutations and just melt down is probably too far out. And on the other hand, we know that it doesn't take that many beneficial mutations to hold off the ratchet. Right? So one doesn't necessarily make sense.
All right, so I will just briefly conclude this. So basically, why is it not working? Okay, so basically here I try to give some ideas of fitness waves. So okay, so this is basically a tree of influenza and the colors are just roughly a coalescent time. But I just want to illustrate the idea in this different context. So people work working on these Bodhausen-Znidman waves, they usually focus on what happens in a piece of this tree. So they do coalescence statistics. But here, as I try to argue, genome evolution is a long-term thing. Yeah, okay. Genome evolution in the very long term needs to take into account all the things like so that happen in the trunk of this tree. So while whether you would be able to have the deleterious mutations here that are just purged from the population, the ones that we are talking about are substitutions, so they are basically coming along in the trunk of this tree. So it's just a different point of view here on these traveling fitness waves. And just to summarize these different regimes that we discussed, I try to talk that substitution patterns can be used to distinguish different evolutionary regimes. So in equilibrium, we had this regime of standing waves, where the fluctuations on substitution dynamics were of small effect, of maximum of order of sigma tilde. We had these large coalescent times. And fluctuations on the dynamics of the substitutions are only of this order. You had basically the same amount of deleterious and beneficial substitutions there. And then we tuned in our adaptive pressure. And when you do that, the first thing is that the coalescent times get a little bit shorter because you start having these sweeps that make the things go through. So we had there fluctuations of the dynamics of substitution happening as in these equilibrium phases, and they were at the size of this sigma tilde. And then we also had these adaptive sweeps that happened through time. So these are marked in these green arrows. So when you try to make adaptation, when you try to increase the this adaptive pressure, then we start having many sweeps. So we start having the fluctuations on these. We start having many sites that are basically molten, and the dynamics of substitution there is happening. Like you have basically neutral substitutions going on. But the point here is that the point we try to make is that this fast mode of adaptation, then it cannot be a long-term mode of evolution, but just a transient thing. And as we argue, genomic viability then limits this long-term speed of adaptation, which make us think about what happens in these laboratory populations, as we have this small discussion before, whether there is something exception, whether it could be because of sex, whether there's something different there. Okay, I guess that's it. Further questions or comments?
I sort of have a question about the second to last point. So how do you know what is viable and what's not viable?
Okay. So because here, so you go there to this, so you go to the occupation probability, right? And then, so then, of course, in the end of the day, if you want to have a threshold, it's always a little bit arbitrary, right? But I mean, if you see that the occupation of the beneficial allele is about 70% or so, I mean, it's...
Is that good or bad?
Yeah. So basically, that's it. But and when you have the occupation of the good and the bad allele being half, is like having a random genome. So the idea with this viability is just like how you carry this genetic information. So if you are in a state where it doesn't really matter if that loci is good or bad, it doesn't really store any genetic information.
But to sort of extend that point, so you know, if you are in a situation where, you know, like selection doesn't really care about whether you flip a locus up or locus down, like, does it matter which way it's pointing? Like, I think so what do you specifically mean by a genome melting down in that situation?
I don't think I understood the beginning. Can you say it again?
I think, like, so why do you care, like, you know, if the evolutionary dynamics are such that like these loci are sort of not strongly selected enough for this population to be, you know, not flipping up and down basically at an appreciable rate, then does it really
okay.
I think it's like the hard and soft selection.
Yeah, but I think the thing there is like you can always have these sites that are behaving quasi neutrally, right? But the what was going on here was that when this effective neutrality thing, this sigma tilde, this effective neutrality scaled, it crosses over the mean selection coefficient of your genome.
That means that essentially all of the sites are neutral now.
So,
or effectively neutral because of drag.
And that is the thing about the... Because how can you have a genome...
Do you need some sort of like stronger assumption about how... You know, because, I don't know, when I think of selection coefficient, I think like, you know, what that describing is some sort of competitive fitness advantage of this locus over the alternative locus, and so on, but I think, you know, like that doesn't really tell me anything about, you know, what the size of the population is doing. Like there's some, so you need some, I don't know, so to describe that as sort of like a meltdown situation for the whole population, you need some coupling between this sort of competitive fitness and like the total, I don't know, like the...
Well, some coupling between the fitness and population there.
Yes, exactly, which it doesn't seem totally non-trivial to me.
Sorry. It's really just a question of, it's the relative fitness that matters,
yeah.
And you're working in a system of, in a fixed population size, right?
Yeah.
So I wasn't clear on that either. So under these conditions, what exactly is meltdown referring to? Right, so the population can't go away, right? Because the population size is fixed. Mm-hmm. So there'll be some genome or distribution of genomes popping about, right? The number is fixed.
Yeah.
So the worst case scenario is that they're just all packed with deleterious
amounts,
right? And of course, in that case, there's plenty of room to move forward and improve, so that will not happen, right? So they won't be all piled up in the deleterious allele state.
So there
should be some sort of equilibrium where the probability of finding a beneficial mutation just offsets the probability of fixing, because they can flip back and forth, right?
You could assume that, for example, you're in this state, and then within the model, you set the mutation rate to zero, and you still have a viable population because you assume a fixed population. So, I mean, it's not.
But I mean, this is not a statement about the population being viable. It's a statement about the genome storing information. So whether genetic information is somehow storing the genome, yeah, like in the sense that. If the site, if most of the sites now don't have a reason to be fixed on the beneficial allele, how can this genome store some heritable information?
That there are too many. Basically, it's just too many deleterious alleles.
I didn't hear.
So for example, maybe what you mean by genome viability is so. I just talked about the situation where all the alleles are deleterious, but now let's talk about the perfect genome where all the alleles are beneficial. And it is entirely possible that the equilibrium state will not actually include that perfect state, right? That you will lose the top bin of the distribution.
Yeah.
So is that what you mean? That out there, the top bin of the distribution is lost, and there is some dynamic equilibrium with sites popping in, alleles popping up and down, but nobody is perfect in that particular distribution. Is that what you mean by that?
I think it's more like most genomes are close to being the opposite of that.
I think so. That the point here is just that when you think of the genome as something that propagates genetic or heritable information, and not like as the evolutionary process as some statistics of mutation, but as the evolutionary process as propagating some genetic information. So that is the whole idea of the meltdown. It's like it comes to a point where if your evolutionary process is in a particular way, here say very fast adaptation, and you have this genome there, so the genome cannot keep up with this storing this genetic information. It becomes like whatever it is doing there, it becomes basically irrelevant. So if you think of this evolutionary process as just like passing down to the next generation some heritable things, like giving your genes or your genetic information to the next generation, you would expect that it's important to give the correct configuration of this genome, right? So you don't. It's just that, like, I wouldn't expect that a genome that is completely random is a viable genome in that sense.
A different way of thinking about it, and you don't tend to ever include phenotypes in these models, but I imagine what you're thinking is that the fit of the organism to the environment is somehow decaying. That is, whatever our concept of adaptation is, that there will be traits that make sense in the environment, and the organism will start accumulating mutations that make that fit poor. That is, overall fitness declines. Even though it's not explicitly coupled to population dynamics, it would still go to our whatever our overall concept of adaptation. I just want to get back to your other question about what else could be different, and this discussion does bring to mind the fact that even if you are occasionally fixing deleterious mutations, the complete absence of epistasis in this model means that you can't have compensatory changes, and that's one solution if you keep accumulating. If the accumulation of deleterious change through draft is inevitable, that does create a new substrate that then you can adapt to. And maybe a lot of adaptation is actually fixing these kinds of problems. And so that can only exist under an epistatic model in which a deleterious mutation is not forever dooming you to be deleterious. There's a different way of fixing that. And I'll talk about this a little bit. I mean, there's lots of empirical evidence that shows that this can happen quite rapidly. I'll talk about it on Wednesday. So.
Ooh.